Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayyad Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Gina Hunter about her book, Edible Insects, A Global History, which was published in 2021 by Reaction Books. Gina is Associate Professor of Anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Illinois State University. She has published research on women's reproductive health, foodways and food systems, the ethnography of the university, and pedagogy and research methods. At Illinois State, she is Director of Office of Student Research and Co-Director of the Food Studies minor and is affiliated with the Latin American and Latino Studies program. Her regional specialty is Brazil and has twice led a study abroad program in Brazil. Gina, thanks for accepting my invitation and welcome to the show.
Hello, Amir, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. To start off, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up as an anthropologist of food, Gina?
Interestingly, I came to the university and began studying. I studied a wide variety of things. I didn't settle on anthropology until my senior year of undergraduate, which is not common, but it's at least possible in our educational system. It's not the case everywhere that you can change your major area of study so easily. But my first loves were horticulture and ethnobotany. So I took a lot of botany and ecology courses as an undergrad. And then when I went to grad school to study anthropology, I really wanted to study, you know, ethnobotany, but navigating interdisciplinarity proved a little bit difficult. I did my graduate work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and they have a lot of interdisciplinary research centers, especially now. But when you're kind of straddling two programs, you have two sets of expectations. And it was quite difficult for me to kind of articulate a good project that satisfied both the botanists and the anthropologists that I was working with. So I was studying those things, and I was also in grad school married and navigating married life with also a son and thinking about, you know, how I was going to do field research, you know, with a family in tow. And so that kind of got me a little bit away from my first loves there. And I was taking a medical anthropology course and reading a lot about Brazil. My ex-husband is Brazilian. And that, you know, and I read about this dramatic fertility decline in Brazil over, you know, from the 1960s to the 1980s, and the fact that female surgical sterilization was one of the predominant ways of fertility control. And so I ended up studying that. So that's how I got to women's reproductive health. And so I lived in Brazil for quite a while and did long-term field work there. So that's kind of, you know, like I kind of feel like now being in food anthropology is a return in a way to something, because I loved economic botany and ethnobotany and especially, you know, food plants and medicinal plants. And so by the time I was an associate professor here at Illinois State, you know, I was post-tenure. I wasn't interested in that line of research in reproductive health anymore. And I was teaching a lot in my program. We had a pretty heavy teaching load as a visiting and then an assistant professor. And as you mentioned, I took students to Brazil in ethnographic field schools. So my publications were on a lot of pedagogical, you know, topics. And I was involved in the local food movement in my community. You know, I'm here in the middle of the U.S. Corn Belt, but 10 or 15 years ago, very little of the food produced in this very rich agricultural land here was actually food for people. It's all commodity corn and commodity soybeans, and that goes mostly for feed and fuel and other things. So, you know, I was reading about food studies, and in anthropology, it had, you know, really grew in the last, say, 20 years. So I started kind of dipping my toes into that literature and co-authored a chapter on the anthropology of food with a senior colleague here, Dr. Robert Dirks. And then I got interested in food as cultural heritage and wrote a little bit about that in Brazil. So that's kind of like my circuitous route from just, you know, anthropology and Brazil and women's health all the way kind of, in a way, a homecoming for me back to food anthropology.
Very interesting journey.
Yeah.
your book, Gina, is published as part of Reaction Books Edible series. And for those listeners who may not be familiar with Edible series, it's a series that focuses on the global history and culture of one type of food or one type of beverage in each of its volumes. And your book, Gina, is on edible insects. So I was wondering, how did this research and the consequent book come about, and why edible insects of all things?
Well, I am not an entomologist, and so this isn't something I had studied before or thought about writing about, really, but I like the edible series. I had read several volumes before. I think the first one I read was Bruce Craig's volume on the hot dog, and I was actually on sabbatical for other work, and I got a list in my email of, you know, upcoming volumes coming out of the series. And as I looked at that list, I noticed that many of the titles were staple foods or common foods in Western cuisines and in Western diets. And I thought about all the foods that were staples in other parts of the world that might be interesting to read about. I thought in particular, given my experience in Brazil, I thought of cassava or manioc, which is a really, you know, just common prevalent food there and a staple food. I'm not even quite sure why, but insects came to mind as something that would be interesting to read about. And I think before that, maybe even, I did have an interest. I've been interested in, you know, like disgust, just where disgust comes from. And so, you know, the idea of eating insects is disgusting to many people. And so that I was, you know, that kind of fascinated me about the topic. And so, you know, I wrote to Andy Smith, the editor of the series, and I just said, you know, I think this would be a good topic. And he was interested and said, well, do you want to write it? Send a proposal. And so I said, well, wow, okay, yeah, maybe I will. And so it took me several years, but then, you know, to actually write it, in part because I balanced that with other research projects I was doing and a lot of admin work at the university and teaching, and also because insects are hard. I had to learn a lot just in general about insects in order to begin to write this book.
I mean, you have now learned a lot about insects, as you are saying. So could you tell us what is an insect, or perhaps what is not an insect? I know you said that you're not an entomologist, and I don't want to get into, you know, deep taxonomy discussion here, but what is an insect? And more importantly, are all insects edible?
That's a good question. Well, first, for insects, I do talk about things that in, you know, that we might call bugs in, you know, in general, we say bugs and we mean all kinds of things that are not technically speaking or taxonomically speaking insects. But, you know, insects are, well, first, I guess we could just say they're arthropods, they're invertebrates. And when mature, they, you know, they invertebrates mean they wear their skeletons on the outside. They're called exoskeletons. And that exoskeleton, the hard exterior, is made of chitin, which is a fiber that's actually hard for most people to digest. So a lot of insects are eaten when they are immature as eggs or pupa or larva. But so insects are animals, and they're, you know, they're the dominant form of life on Earth. There's over a million known species, and scientists don't know how many millions of yet to be identified species that are out there. So I like to say, I'm kind of afraid of spiders. I've gotten less of fearful of bugs, but I always like to say, well, I don't have to get used to spiders or like them because they're not technically insects. So I say, oh, I wrote about it. I'm a specialist in edible insects here, but I don't have to like the spiders or some of the other creepy crawly things we call bugs. But most of the books that talk about edible insects will also talk about just the general category of bugs, or, you know, even crustaceans and other things that people will kind of classify in that same group. I tried to limit it mostly to insects.
Mm. And where did this insect eating begin? I mean, is it a recent thing, or is it something that we've been doing for a long time?
Oh, well, yeah, we humans have been eating insects. Probably it's as old as humanity. We don't have a lot of direct archaeological evidence because it's hard to find and has often been overlooked. But we have cave paintings of people harvesting honey. And I think when we think of honey, we think of that as a product. And certainly that's maybe the most popular insect byproduct that we have, but that's edible anyway. But the bee brood, that is the nest itself, is also edible and is eaten by people. So we have cave paintings around several places of the world that are tens of thousands of years old, representing honey and bee hunting, and then, you know, representations of locust eating in the Middle East, and so we have lots of evidence, and then archaeological evidence, direct evidence in like coprolites, the fossilized feces of you know, insect parts, and we have those direct for thousands of years ago, you know, dated to thousands of years ago. And so I think, well, we even know that our primate relatives will eat insects, like chimpanzees, that, you know, will actually devise tools and to fish out, say, termites from a log, and that they eat them. So I think that it is very much a part of our, you know, it's a part of our humanity, and maybe part of our animality, actually, to eat insects.
But why do we eat insects anyway? I mean, is it the nutritiousness? Is it the taste? Is it the availability? Is it the affordability? I mean, what is it that makes us, or have made us in the past, to eat insects? And I don't know the answer to this question depends on the when and the where, but just a general overview that you, in your research, at least for this book, have come to learn.
Well, you know, one answer, well, you had asked me earlier, you know, how many are all insects edible, and I would say probably not, but we really don't know how many are, because that's very difficult to know. You know, I think people probably ate insects because they were there and they were hungry. And some insects, we think of them sometimes as these little things, right? For the most part, small, and compared to other conventional meat, you know, mammals, and that they're, you know, insects are very small, but swarming in insects appear in vast numbers at times. And so you can collect a lot of insects in a short period of time. So, you know, I think that you know, there's a lot of, you know, and it there's, it's just from a long history of making great use, as people always did, of the environment that they're in and all of the things that the environment have offered, that insects would be a part of that. So yes, they're very nutritious. They're like other meats. So they contain lots of protein and fat. It's hard to say anything absolutely general about insects, you know, but they're other, you know, they're like other animals, and depending on the life cycle stage and that, they can be very, have a lot of protein and a lot of fat. So they're comparable to other meats. So yeah, so I think people, I mean, I think there's evidence, and there's evidence certainly from all over the world of people eating insects, but more in the tropics than in temperate areas. And that's probably just because there's more insects in the tropics and, you know, more more opportunities to find a good one, a good bug.
Mm. And I want to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, Gina. I mean, when we mentioned the idea of eating insects, one of the first things that people usually say is that, oh, that's disgusting. And that idea of disgust has been being explored in, especially in anthropology, for a long time now. I mean, how disgust is culturally evolved, how it is socially constructed, the role it plays or has played in dining norms within different groups of people and all that. Now, could you talk a little bit about the notion of disgust within the context of insect eating?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you were to ask most Americans, you know, if you ask them why they, or, you know, what they think about eating insects, they react with, you know, disgust, or, you know, and they believe that it is, that this visceral rejection must be natural, right? So, and as anthropologists, we know that, you know, we always question that, but, Paul Rosen is probably the scholar most associated with the study of disgust and its various forms. There are different, he's classified different kinds of disgust. But, you know, part of the association of disgust with insects is that, you know, some say that, you know, well, insects can be associated with disease. So if we avoid insects, it's in part, perhaps due to a fear of pathogens. Some associate insects with, I mean, insects are part of, they do this really important ecological service for us, which is helping with decomposition. So insects decompose, you know, vegetable and other matter. And so that association with decay and death and decomposition might be seen as some, as a origin of disgust. But as you said, most, you know, none of that really holds up if you look cross-culturally. And, you know, like most food habits and preferences, it's cultural. And so how that evolved, that in the West predominantly we find insects kind of generally, with very few exceptions, that we find insects disgusting is a really complicated, you know, historical question, because we do have evidence of, say, the Romans, you know, eating certain kinds of insects, and you know, in history, and we find some evidence of peasants and others, and there are isolated what's the Sardinian cheese? I mentioned it in the book. That's, you know, has a kind of maggot in it that is a specialty. Although I like to say that Kazumarzu, I think that's the name. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but and I think that people, you know, they think of that as just a specialty, and they certainly wouldn't think of themselves as insect eaters. It's just that particular dish, and that's, you know, probably the world over, people eat a particular bug and maybe prepared a particular way or at a particular life stage, and not, you know, never think of themselves as insect eaters. But so our broad dismissal of most insects is a little bit unusual. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that might account for that in the West. Some of the proposal, some of the things I talk about in the book are the fact that there's simply in, say, in Europe, there were fewer species available. So, and with agriculture and climate changes, there may have, you know, what once would have been an abundant food source might have become at a later period less likely. And by the time you have a lot of colonization, this insect eating, which wasn't very common in Europe, that becomes associated with the other and with primitive, so-called primitive peoples, right? And it comes to be seen as primitive. And because of that, many people, even in the colonized world, then associate that with backwardness and a desire to not be seen as backward or primitive and wanting to modernize. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons why maybe, you know, people who once ate insects don't anymore. And it's not, I think, a resolved question. But I don't know. I think I got off track and probably didn't fully answer your question. Oh,
no, you definitely did. And I want to follow up on something really important that you mentioned there. I imagine there must be some ethical dilemmas associated with insect eating too, right? I mean, you mentioned like ecological reasoning. I mean, arguments both for and against eating insects. What are they?
Well, it depends. I suppose if you are a strict vegan, then you may not want to eat insects. I mean, there's a question about how sentient insects are, but, you know, they are animals. And so those who are strict vegans just would maybe choose not to, for that reason of not wanting to eat living things. Of course, we eat insects all the time without knowing it, but, you know, that's not the intentional consumption of them. But usually the argument for an increasing consumption of insects today in the West is that it's good for the environment. And so it's seen as a positive, you know, ethical food choice for having a diet that is earth friendly. And certainly raising crickets for cricket protein powder is far more sustainable than our conventional meat sources, especially if we think of like beef, which is, you know, the perhaps the worst environmental offender. But, you know, so it, crickets can be produced with far less arable land and water use and feed. And so you can get, you know, far much more protein out of that than other conventional meats. But, you know, they're not a free lunch either, because they require feed inputs themselves, and the quality of the feed determines the quality of the, you know, the nutrition that the crickets will offer. So, you know, I always, when people ask me, oh, should we be eating more bugs? I say, well, you know, and yes, if you're going to have, I mean, part of the problem right now is that most of the insect foods we find on the market are snacks, you know, so it's not, they're just an addition to our diets rather than a replacement for something less ecologically sustainable. But so I tell students and others when they ask that if you want that the ecologically sustainable diet is plant-based, at least for most places and most people in the world. So that's one. That's another. That's the main. And that was really one of my inspirations for writing the book, is that when I started looking into insects as foods, I just saw a little bit of hype, especially around the new market for food and commercial food out, you know, a lot of eating insects will save the world, you know, basically. I was very skeptical and had to look into that. And so while I think that, you know, farming insects is potentially a great way to diversify a smallholder's farm income, you know, if there's a place to, and you know, so there could be some uses for it for that. But most of the large, we increasingly see these huge indoor, you know, robotic, environmentally, you know, just climate controlled, you know, huge plants that are really factory farming of insects. And, you know, a lot of that goes for feed, not for human food. And a lot of it goes to, and even that for human consumption is still often going for, like I said, those snack bars and Chirps chips and other snacky things rather than to kind of feed the world, so to speak. So I think that, you know, that was one of the points I wanted to make in the book. And then I suppose another problem is that, you know, not all insects are, I mean, most insects eaten worldwide are, you know, harvested, not farmed. And so they're wild harvested or maybe semi-cultivated, you know, where people facilitate the collection of insects facilitate plantings that will encourage insects and that. And in those places, I'm thinking of like the Mopani worms in southern Africa and Zimbabwe. They're a caterpillar actually that feed on Mopani trees, and increasing demand for that in urban centers has led to over-harvesting of and damage of Mopani trees. And so there's some worries about, you know, whether or not promoting wild collected edible insects can actually be cause some problems with over-harvesting and be an environmental decline. So I think there's, you know, those are some of the kind of ethical and kind of, you know, dilemmas associated with, you know, becoming an insectivore.
And at the end of the book, you also include some recipes featuring insects. That's my favorite part of the book, actually. Where did these recipes come from? Is there a story behind them or behind how you found or chose them?
Oh, they were hard. They were really hard to come up with because, yeah, these, you know, the edible series, all of them have insects at the recipes at the end. So, you know, it was part of writing this book that I was going to find recipes. And, you know, many insects that you encounter, you know, in markets day. So I went to Oaxaca in Mexico, and I actually, when I was researching this book, to be in a place where insects are still very commonly found on, you know, in the market and on menus. And so I had some really delicious, a whole variety of insects prepared in different ways. But often if you go, so for example, in Thailand and you go to big street food markets, and even actually in Oaxaca, you'll see the large markets full of chapulines, the grasshoppers that are eaten. And, you know, these insects are just prepared very simply. They're just fried, you know, so they'll be collected and then boiled or roasted or fried, and you just eat them like that. And so that's not very interesting in terms of a, you know, epicurean interest in, you know, or even really knowing, you know, like interesting recipes. But I think that is not necessarily indicative of the potential of the and how people might have traditionally prepared them. Is Joshua Evans at the Nordic Food Lab and a team there have written a lot about the taste profile of bugs and went around the world for their, I think the film is called Bugs and or Eat a Bug. And it's really wonderful view of the different ways in which people around the world prepare different kinds of insects. So I draw a little bit from the Nordic Food Lab and their research. I looked for historical accounts of the different ways that insects were prepared. And then, you know, there are the proponents of insect eating today have often are experimenting with different kinds of recipes for home-raised bugs like mealworms and crickets and other things. And so I was looking at, I included a few of those. So, you know, one of the things, you know, I think it's what's fascinating is that you have all these, a lot of insects that are just kind of collected and roasted and eaten or pounded into a powder and preserved. But then you have other examples like giant water bug essence, which is, I think, one of the first recipes I have in there, which involves harvesting just two little small glands the size of a rice grain, you know, from male water bugs to get the liquid inside. And a few drops of that is used to flavor pickle sauces. And this is in Vietnamese cuisine. And so it's like, you have to wonder, how did anybody ever discover that, right? How did they find that? And so so I just included various examples, and I tried to, you know, present a diversity of food things, like for flavoring or as, some simple preparations, and then some that are more complicated. I obviously was not able to test all of these. So it's not a kitchen tested cookbook, I would say, in part because it's very difficult to get good insects in the market. I mean, I could get some freeze dried, and I did. I ordered all these different bugs. They come to you kind of just dried, and you know, something that's probably would be eaten as a fresh grub, which is very fatty and rich, and could be something like cracklings or whatever. If it were prepared fresh, if you order it in mail order, it comes to you as like kind of a dried prune. It's just really just not the same. So
yes, that was actually my next question, that, you know, have you tried any of your of these recipes, which you've already answered, but are you, and this is a personal question, so please feel free to forego it, but are you an insect eating individual?
Yeah,
like, well, intentionally.
Absolutely. It's very first for the book. I had some residual resistance myself from my upbringing, and some bugs would probably still be very difficult for me to eat. But I sought out places. Like I said, I went to Oaxaca just to try different kinds of insect foods, and I went to a conference on edible insects, and where there was an exhibitors fair and other people who were sharing insect foods. And I've tried them. And so whenever I travel, I look for opportunities to try insects. I raise my own mealworms and have eaten those. And I've harvested June bugs from my yard and eaten those. So I have, it's not that it's something I will regularly do. And I certainly wouldn't say that it's my main protein source by any means, but I'm curious about insects and their various tastes, and so it's kind of like other foods, it's worth trying.
Exactly. To wrap up the interview, Gina, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, or are you thinking about doing a research on a particular topic in a near future, not necessarily food related, any project?
Oh, yeah. Well, I am. Actually, I have just completing part of a project on the slow food movement that started in Italy and then spread around the world. It's a global, very large global movement now. And a political scientist and I, who's a colleague here at Illinois State, we've been researching the slow food movement and doing interviews with a lot of leaders, international leaders, and counselors from around the world about changes within that movement and how, efforts to make it an inclusive, truly global and solidary movement with small-scale producers, peasant communities, and indigenous peoples around the world. And so so we've been studying that and are wrapping up an article right now that's kind of phase one of that project. And then so I'm not sure where that's going to take us, but I'm interested in future research on slow food in other parts of the world, in slow food Brazil, for example, and continuing a little bit of work that my current research has uncovered. So that's basically my current research.
Like a very interesting project and very important too. I can't wait to read it whenever it comes out. Do we know when it is coming out? I know this is a
no,
really
we are just
difficult
getting
question
ready
to ask your researcher.
I'm literally hoping to submit the article tomorrow. So it is not even submitted yet. We've presented on it a number of times, but not submitted it for publication. So it is just now going out. We found ourselves, we went to the big event of slow food in Turin, Italy, which is called Terra Madre. And we did that in 2018. That was last one. And then COVID hit, and we continued interviews on Zoom, but like everybody else, sent us in scrambling as teachers and administrators, and so a lot of things kind of had to be put on hold for a little while.
I can relate to that. Thank you so much, Gina, for coming on the show and speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your wonderful work with our listeners. I really enjoyed reading the book. It was a really interesting topic and very well written, but I enjoyed it even more to talk about it with you. So thank you very much.
Well, it has been a pleasure talking to you, and I am just delighted to be here and talk a little bit more about this book and this topic. I think we have a lot to learn from people who traditionally ate insects and who continue to eat insects. And so I like to spread the word wherever I can.
Thank you very much, Gina. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Amir.